This is November.
Laurie's not going to say anything, he's just going to tape.
This is November 19th, Reel 9. Ed Banchelor is questioning Ray about the events of the riot.
In 67. You were asking Ed about the type people in the Blind Pig. No, they weren't underworld. They weren't. Now, this is from observation of people who knew them or had seen them before, because they were not kept at the police station. So, another crazy thing. They took them all over and got the whole city burning down and dismissed them immediately, which was all right with me, because they take people, the police take people with a standard operating procedure, customers in a Blind Pig or a dope joint or a house of prostitution, take them in, hold them overnight, take them to court as lawyers, and they're dismissed, particularly a Blind Pig. So all this trouble, it's police procedure, but all this trouble, none of the, there are 80-some people in there, none of the customers had anything happen to them at all. Wasn't even locked up.
That's kind of ironic at that.
Yeah.
There is a charge that could have been brought, though.
Like,
frequenting.
Legal
resort.
Yeah. Loitering or busy or frequenting. It could. It's a misdemeanor, but we never get a prosecution unless it's in quite an unusual circumstance. They bring them in. It's harassment. But with the thousands of Blind Pigs that existed and exist in Detroit, I don't think, in any way, that this is a very effective form of harassment. I think you're taking a hell of a chance doing it. The musician from that civil suit, incidentally, just lost it, from the Chop House, what was the name, that was picked up on a $5 or $10 traffic warrant on his way home one morning, and the warrant was from Warren, Michigan, not even Detroit warrant, and he was put cell in the 13th, in the bullpen in the 13th precinct. Then the police brought in a lot of unruly men from a Blind Pig raid, and they beat this guy. They almost killed this poor musician. You remember
the story? I remember the case.
He just lost his civil, his civil case against the city. But, see, they bring those people in when they, I think, should send them on their way. Now, I also think that if that riot, if they hadn't taken the 80 in on the installment plan, they didn't call for the buses or the wagons, they just took them two or three at a time. If that hadn't brought on a riot, some other incident would have that summer. Detroit, for some reason, was despite all the work we did, it was, I think we just had to get in. If the greatest strategist in the world had planned it, they couldn't have worked out a better time of the week or the day to stage it, because we had nobody at work, and we don't. You have 4,300 men, and just work out the logistics of that, working a 40-hour week with the ones that are required to stay inside. The detective works, of course, and everything. You don't have enough patrol. And certainly no city has enough to handle a riot and their normal duties as well.
Ray, you mentioned the greatest strategy. This might be a good time to, I think, I'm pleased to hear your version, but there was thoughts of a conspiracy at the time. We had some guy named Louis Lomax, a black journalist, who came and wrote a
about the salesman, door-to-door salesman.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people may remember that series. It might be a good time to nail that right now.
All right, there are two or three things. Lomax wrote about door-to-door salesmen. They thought were sort of advancement and also stirring up the thing. Another was that even some of the police in the 10th precinct told me two things about that night, that they saw more Ohio license plates than ever, than normal, in the 12th Street area. And the other was that some of the most active seemed to be wearing a red type t-shirt. Well, we couldn't get into that, you know, like in 2 minutes after it started, but we did get into it as soon as we could get our breath. And we could not substantiate, the police department could not substantiate that any of this had anything to do. Now, my theory, and it's got to be a theory, because we can't support it all with facts, is that it was a combination of circumstances. That during the heat and intensity of the situation, you might find again, as other circumstances, it would result in a riot. There were people on the street, I'm convinced, whose job it was to stir things up. Once there was a police incident, these people would get in it. Now, two or three were identified in this crowd as stirring up the crowd. This was a, remember, when the raid took place, and it was spontaneous, so this couldn't have been planned. I'll explain that in a minute. But when the police did start to bring out of the blind pig, the prisoners, the crowd was in a jovial mood. They were hollering at him, well, we'll send you some cigarettes to Jackson Joe, and, you know, bantering back and forth. But gradually, and this damn transport business took so long, gradually the temper of the crowd turned and was being changed, and according to the police who were there and what they tell me in putting it together, the crowd was manipulated. And I think this is true, because we know we've seen it during those three or four summers in particular, that there'd be one, in every at least one, every time there'd be an incident in a crowded black neighborhood. I ran into it personally. I was with the superintendent one night, and we were on 12th Street, and this was prior to the riot, and we got a call, policeman in trouble, and before we could get there, they said everything was under control, and then another one, this police vehicle hit a car with several civilians, on, we'll say Seward, a block off 12. So we did manage to get through. Now, by the time we got there, and it was only a few minutes, there must have been 300 or 400 people already at the scene. They just barrel out of those apartment houses. And it looked bad, because the civilians were, there's some children, they're lying on the ground bleeding. It looked as if the police car had run right into the side of this other car. The policeman had already been taken to the hospital. It was hard to get scout cars in to through the crowd to take the other injured to the hospital. We finally got him up on the sidewalk, and I said to Reuter, hang on to your hat, this could be it. Because the crowd was, you know, not a happy crowd at all, or hostile. But somebody said, my God, there's a commissioner, when I got over there. And it seemed that little thing, my being there, seemed to turn the crowd in favor of old Jesus. Is he interested? You know, are they really interested? They were friendly. And they could have been brutal, as it turned out. Investigation, you know, later, took a day or two, but the car with the women and the children had turned in front of the police car, and the police car was speeding to get to help the officer in trouble. So it, the police car did hit the side, but they made a sudden turn right in front of them. So it was not the police car's fault, but it certainly looked that way, and I thought we'd have a... I was really expecting big trouble that night. I kind of think the fact that we were on the street and taking an interest and doing everything we could to get the people to the hospital turned it. But they, one person, very loud, "Why is it? I want to know why it is they take the policemen but they to the hospital, but they leave these little children here and thing." So I turned to a uniformed patrolman and I said, "Take him to the scout car and get his story. We want witnesses like this." And I said, "Get, you tell him everything, you know, that we did wrong. Take him to the scout car right away." Well, the guy, it was a good hindsight play because the guy did just what I thought. He took it on the deaf
phone
right through the crowd. He didn't want to get in any scout car for any reason. He was hot for some reason already.
Sure.
But he might have been a Nathan provocateur. He might have been, I don't know what the hell he was. He might have been just some guy who thought it was wrong. The reason the policemen were taken first, maybe it was a fraternity type thing. I think it might be natural if it did, I mean, understandable if it just happened they were taken first. However, they both had what appeared to be, and turned out to be rather, serious head injuries. The others were not as seriously hurt, and they took the two who had the head injuries. But
Ray, I bet none of that appeared in the papers, right?
Nothing.
The newspapers were not interested, am I right, Eddie, in reporting confrontations that summer?
No, I don't think they were.
They weren't. Pardon me.
I think it might have all have been, and as I say, I'm not high in the executive councils, but I think it might have been all an idea that any discussion of confrontations could be have a incendiary effect. I think that would be the justification if there was any other. It might just be plain laziness or on the part of the...
Well, maybe I don't get a very objective view, but, I didn't from where I was sitting at that time. But it struck me that every damn thing that was that reflected on the police was printed. If some irresponsible loudmouth got up on a soapbox or came to my outer office and yelled police brutality, and boom, that sure got in the paper. But it seemed, now maybe I'm not right about that, because it's pretty hard to be objective when you're getting that kind of thing every day and you're breaking your neck to see it doesn't happen. And you're sort of like a voice in the wilderness and that thing. But it was true. Well, it was, I know this, Maury, that in 1940, before the 1943 riots, I was away during the riots, I was in the Army, but the summer before, there were all sorts of black and white fights on the streets, gang fights. And this, we never printed them, and this was intentional. On the theory that, don't say anything about it, it'll go away. And because this I discussed with the people who made the policy, and the papers, whether they got together or did it individually, I don't remember, but I know that none of them printed those fights, and they were pretty big fights. Belle Isle, Jefferson, well, all around town. You see a lot of the both black and whites who come up from the South. And maybe they're all homegrown people, I don't know. But whatever, there are a lot of fights that we never printed, a lot of serious incidents that we never printed.
Ray, you say that...
But the theory didn't work out because it was out of the right.
These troublemakers, you were saying the mood of the crowd changed, and there seemed to be a couple of troublemakers who had something to do with this about
yes.
face, and plus yeah. this delay. As I understand it, here again, a lot of the events of early Sunday morning are cloudy in the papers. You find all kinds of conflicts.
Yeah.
The, Was there kind of a shuttle service of taking these blind pig patrons up to the 10th precinct?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
What happened was, I don't know why nobody thought to get the buses, which will take a large number of people. They couldn't or didn't try to get enough autos, which take 14. You can get 14 in, 12 is the number, but you can squeeze some extra. So they're taking them back and forth, as you say, in a shuttle.
Oh, scout cars?
Scout cars.
Uh-huh. No paddy wagons.
I think there's one.
One, yeah.
Yeah, one.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got precincts around there with the what they call the auto. That's a patrol wagon. And they could have gotten two or three more.
Yeah, sure.
did you discuss who made the decision to tip over this place?
Well, I was coming back to that. Every precinct at that time had what they called a cleanup crew, usually a sergeant and two or three men. Sometimes we didn't have enough sergeants then, ever. So sometimes it'd be three patrolmen. This crew had a sergeant who was white and two black patrolmen in plain clothes. He was in plain clothes. Cleanup works that way, in an unmarked car, that a six-year-old kid in the ghetto can spot seven blocks away because they're all Plymouths, they all have the same area, they might just as well have a big sign on them. They knew that this blind pig operated. Oh yeah, one of the criticisms, why did you raid it on a weekend? Well, that's the only time they're open.
Mm-hmm.
See, they just opened on weekends, and this was Saturday night, Sunday morning. At 10 o'clock that night, one of the black officers in plainclothes, who was not known, took another one, a new man, who was very tall, and tried to get in. He talked to the door. Mine pig was on the second floor. There was a doorman at a locked door at the street. And he told him that this tall fellow was a basketball player from so-and-so, and he was just showing him around and wanted to get in. So they couldn't get in. This was 10 o'clock. Now, they just didn't have a chance of getting in. So they went on about their other duties, checking all the things they have to check. And at 3 o'clock, they were passing the place, and they saw two rather well-dressed girls, unaccompanied, who were obviously not prostitutes, headed for the door, and one of the vice squad guys on a hunch said, "Stop the car, let's go, we're going with them." Because, see, you get a better chance of getting in later than early for two reasons. One is the doorman has had a few drinks by that time, as a rule, and he's a little more careless. And two is he's busy, and the third, he's tired. So they just got right up against by these girls, and some other man was going in, was not connected with any of them. And the doorman just passed him this time, where he turned around 5 hours before. It was the same doorman. They didn't know the girls. The girls didn't pay any attention. But I remember in the blind pig days, you'd ring a bell, and the man or woman who ran the blind pig would look at the door and say, "How many?" They might know you as well as I know you, gentlemen. But he'd say to you, "How many of you are there?" Just to avoid a thing like that. Others cried that was an old trick where they just joined the party. And you'd say, "There are three in my party." And he'd say, "Well, who, but three? You know, I just stand there. Who are you? What do you want in here? We don't have anything that interests you." Get alive. So they got in. Now, the girls were You asked me about the tight people. They had the girls pegged, the police did, as secretary, something like that. They were all black. There weren't any white people in that raid. And well-dressed, you know, nicely dressed. And decent girls who were probably had been out visiting, and on the way said, one of them said to the other, "I know it is a blind pig, let's get a drink." Mm-hmm. And this is the way the police had them figured. So, and it's very possible, because there's a mixture of people, I suppose, just like 12th Street was always a mixture of people. The businessman, the prostitute, the saloon keeper, the junkie, the whole, it's name it and you have it on 12th Street all night long, all day long. Of course, as I say, it was so, we had nothing to put it down with, and it just, those people came out of their homes, out of their apartments, and joined in the freeloading. And many of them, you know, wondered why. I'll repeat for this. I told this to Eddie, but I don't want to go over it. But the second day, we knew that a lot of law-abiding, working, decent people who owned their own homes and kept them up nicely on the streets leading into 12, had joined in this pillage and wondered what the hell was going to happen. So Reuter came into my office, the superintendent, and he said, "Well, just got the first call." A man called up and he said my name, and gave us his name and address, and said, "The darnest thing happened. I just went out my back door and there's a big, beautiful television on my back porch, and I don't know how it got there. Now, what am I going to do?" So I said, "You tell him, thank him, tell him we'll pick it up, then we appreciate his cooperation. We'll certainly try to find the villain who did a thing like that to him." But see, a lot of these people, and Hubert Locke, they'd leave stuff out of his house and he'd bring it back in his car. The second day, or even that night, they'd say, "Gee, what the hell? I'm not a thief. What did I get in this for?" But it was like, as I said, Ed Joe Hudson opened his doors and said, "Come on in, everybody, and help yourself." And they went, many of them berserk, because I saw the same expression on the faces of some of the people hurrying away with an armful of stuff that they probably couldn't even use, that I saw on the faces of prisoners in prison riots that I've covered as for the newspaper, and I've covered several. And it's a wild, glazed look, and they're doing, I suppose, their actions and their look is what's meant by person going berserk. They're burning and looting and taking things that they don't want and destroying things that are meaningful to the convicts. Their gymnasium, their athletic equipment, even books, the library they burn. They burn the auditorium where they have movies. And without any sense at all, it's not selective. And maybe there's an analogy between prisoners in a prison and prisoners in the ghetto. Maybe there's a very definite analogy there. And maybe the same thing happens to them once they explode. I don't know. No, a strange thing during that riot, which, as you know, is the biggest in the country, most costly in lives and money, and we had to get the National Guards and our people couldn't stop it, so we had to get the president to send the army in, regular army, and then it took time. I think that General Throckmorton and
Cyrus Vance.
Cyrus Vance. I think they were just stunned at the very fact that they had arrived when it was announced. And with regular army troops, didn't stop the riot like that. They kept right on, they got right the whole thing. And just some of the things to remember, Cyrus Vance was a bug for getting things back to normal. Well, nobody wanted things back to normal more than I did. So he'd say, look, put on the street, one thing he had, put on the street, put the street lights back on, the 12th. Put the lights back on. Jesus Christ, I knew what it was like out of there. You put the, and I knew how the cops and the soldiers figured that lights would just set them up to get shot from a sniper. So finally I said, all right, we'll turn the lights on. So they turned the lights on, and the soldiers and police immediately shot them out. You see, because they knew that they were just making targets out of them.
Ray, there's a sequence in there, and it's understandable because, like policemen, the reporters were all away at that time. You know, that's the time when the newspapers were all dead. But there's a sequence in there. I read and reread the clippings on this thing and Hubert Locke's book and everything, where we have the crowd in an ugly mood as they're lugging these people off, the blind pig people off to the pokey, and the crowd gets in an ugly mood, and then we have it, a rock or a bottle being thrown at the departing cruiser vehicle, and then there's a lapse of about, it seemed to me, about an hour where you're not quite clear from that throwing the bottle, did the crowd fan out and start looting, or what the hell happened?
The last car that was pulling away, someone threw a bottle or a rock through the back window. The car had a couple of prisoners. Now, I think wisely, they kept right on going. There were a few police, I think, still in the general neighborhood. The place had been turned back to the doorman. They took his name and address and told him to lock up, and it was secured. Then it wasn't long before, we have to piece this together too, because we don't have good observers. Somebody threw something through a plate glass window. Then the thing sort of built. Now, it took us some time to react to it because the police in the station were busy with all these 83 people. They were starting to take their names and addresses, starting to do something about it. You know, it's a, and it took a little time. Then they came back on. By the time the few police that we had could get there, the thing was well underway, and this took, well, I don't know the length of time to build.
The looting was well
underway. The police couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. They made some arrests. Oh, they made quite a few arrests. They said that the police and, you know, Mary Beckham, stuff like that, said there weren't police that sat there. That's not true. They made quite a few arrests that day, and a lot of black people pointed out looters and firebombers and gave the police the information. And I know of several instances where things like that happen. Go to the police and say this, man. So they made arrests, and they even got some property back that day. But you must remember that we had in the city of Detroit 100, and we can correct this figure, we'll have to check it, 113, I think, police on the street. My first thought when Reuter called me at 5 was, this might be a diversion. East side was hot too. You know,
what was happening on the east side? Right?
No, I say that my 12th Street might be a diversion for something. With such small number of men, I said, keep your east side men there.
Wait, what time don't did the shift change?
You should go into that because it was a revelation to me.
Yeah. The night shift comes on at midnight of uniformed and a few detectives, but at midnight Saturday, that midnight shift till 8 Sunday morning is a lighter shift. There aren't as many on.
So you had more men coming in at 8.
On another ship, not in addition to,
no,
to take
the
ship. But this, you've got, we had about 4,300 men for a city of 1.5 million and 139 square miles. With nobody to protect it. You've got 4,300 men, and you've got many on vacation, sick. You've got men working inside. You got a 40-hour week. So your number you can put on the street is never a fraction of what you need. Well, after about 3:30 on Sunday morning, things just, crime just practically takes a holiday. There's nothing going on. You see the saloons close. The bars get the last one out at 2:30. So the guy walks home and his wife's got him locked out. He kicks the door in, she shoots him. They go over, you know, and they take her and him to the hospital, her, boom, they know there's going to be no case. They tidy up the streets a little bit, and then it dies. All right, every minute you got to count because you're paying these guys 1.5 times. So you have the least need for the police from about 3:30. Roughly, until Monday morning, on the day shift, Monday. You don't have anything Sunday. Sunday's the lightest crime day. So you have a minimal number of people working from about, from 4 o'clock, really. Because, now that particular night, we, at 4 o'clock, all our cruisers had gone home. Our TMU, all our special units, our cleanups, our vice, our auto boosters, detectives, and it was a much smaller uniform shift that was coming on at 8.
So you had a 4-hour jam between the end of the...
But Sunday you don't have many men either.
Yeah.
So what we did was keep the uniform men, who are normally would have gotten through it, keep them on the others, and try to get as many back as possible. And I contacted the state police, Fred Davids. He lined people up. He said, "Do you want us in?" I said, "Not yet, but try to get some people in from Ishraming, will you, Fred, and get them, you know, like at about our precinct." Because at this time, which is very early in the morning, I didn't know how bad this was going to be.
When did Rudy call you, Rudy?
5 o'clock. And it took me forever to get out of this house because then every son of a bitch and his brother called. And I had to make a couple of calls too. You can see how that works.
Sure.
Hubert Locke called me. The Longworth Quinn called me. He said, "Send men out here." Like, here was a guy that's yelling police brutality in his paper all the time. And he wanted us to shoot them. He wanted us. And the next edition of his paper had Nate Cowan on the headline saying, "It could have been stopped." You know, he kept yelling, "Stop it, they're burning, they're looting," and get policemen. I said, "Well, where in the fuck am I going to get policemen?" And, you know, we might have more if you'd shut up before today.
What was your head count roughly, Ray, say around 4 o'clock that morning?
4 o'clock, we had 2, I can tell you. I've got it up. I can give you the exact figures, but it was after 4 o'clock, just like a few minutes after 4 o'clock, it'd be roughly 220 for the whole city, but only 113 on the streets. The others would be in communications, in the station, you know, and the various jobs that have to do to support the ones in the state. Now, cut that down to 113, make it 112, that's not the right figure, but just say 112. That'd be 56 cars, wouldn't it? Because 2 men cars, mm-hmm. 56 cars. All right, split them down the middle, 25 for all east of Woodward and 25 for all west. You've got nothing. And it's still about that bad, although they've got 1,000 more men. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've never had enough. And this was, of course, the thing that kept us up awake nights worrying about. But there's no better way to deploy what you've got. And we did. We had taken, I managed to get, before that, at least 100 policemen out of desk jobs and places and put them on the street and hire civilians or make do with less just to get more men out there because we didn't have enough and we don't today.
Well, Ray, your deployment of men then was related to the frequency of crime.
Right.
Was there a different frequency or in terms of when riots start? Was there any...
Yeah, riots started, all the riots had started on a week night at around 7, 8 o'clock. Well, just like the one on Kirchhoff in Detroit, but I'm speaking of around the country. They all started around that time, around 7, 8 o'clock in weekday evening. Always hot, you know, always summer, always hot weather. And Kirchhoff followed that pattern, but we had manpower at Kirchhoff. And we didn't have such a density of population, and we had a better street to work on because Kirchhoff was wider. We had the backing and the help of the community, which we didn't have on 12th Street. They went the other way and joined the looters and burners. Then the big problem was, how do you contain them? If we keep them right there, I mean, right off two blocks of 12th Street is lost, which is the very best we could think of. How in the hell do we contain them? Somebody says, tear gas. Says, Christ, no. Tear gas is going to bring people out of those hot apartments, you know, and put more in the street. It's going to spread them to... what's the next? Not Dexter, but
Linwood.
It's going to do a lot of things that we just don't want done. Tear gas, usually, unless the conditions are ideal, is a dangerous weapon to use because often the thrower gets gets right back in the tank. And this day, it was a warm, it was a hot day, but there was winds and gusts up to 25 miles an hour. So we were, you know, the winds were going in all directions.
Who was in command on the scene? Who was the highest ranking officer on the scene?
Lieutenant Raymond Good at the beginning. And he worked, he got hit in the head with a brick and really banged, but he kept on and working. Was the highest one. Now, of course, the question is asked many times, why didn't you shoot? Well, my position, very simply, is I didn't want to commit murder. And I don't think you kill a person under circumstances like that because he's stealing a lot of shoes that won't fit his or a television set. They can't be replaced, but, life can't. I don't do it. The other reason is, although the first was the prevailing reason, but the other is that we had about 25 policemen out there. That was the most we could get. And my feeling is that not one of them would have escaped alive if there had been any shooting. And I was talking to one of the sergeants about that, giving him my theory on it, and he said, no, I think you're wrong. I think maybe one of us is wrong.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But you see, no one who hasn't been in a mob realizes. Why don't you say something? Well, what the hell? Nobody can hear anybody. The noise of the thing, even with bullhorns. Now, I knew when Conyers, Keith, the others, wanted to go out there with Hubert, I knew it would do no damn good in the world. For the simple reason that it hadn't accomplished anything in any other city where there had been riots, and they'd all tried it. But I said, fine, sent them out and bullhorn, and I think, really, they were practically, I don't like to make jokes of color, but they were practically white when they came back.
Mm-hmm.
They
that
were
was
really
the
shaken.
Morning.
That was Sunday morning. about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, when they went out to 12, and Connors got up on an automobile, and the mob started to rock the car, and he had a bullhorn. Nobody listened to him. They were lucky to get out of there. So it reached a point where, as I say, when people are berserk, you know, reason, it's got to be for us. I don't know any other way. I mean, just say, help yourself or use force, and you don't have force. And I started to say, well, we tried to contain it. We didn't want tear gas. We didn't want a lot of things. Then some of the police came out from the commandos. I asked Murray, when I became police commissioner, after I was had time to get my coat on up and all, you know, after a few days, I asked, I believe the superintendent, to give me the plans for our riot plans. And he says, what riot plans? I said, well, you know, if Detroit has a riot because things are tense around it, there's a revolution now, you know, you've read the papers. What are our contingencies? What are our plans? He said, oh, we don't have any plans. We got the commandos. Well, the commandos are, did I say this to you?
No,
I said
no. Yeah.
The commandos are about 12 or 14 big old men in the police department from stationary traffic. You know, they have to be very tall. And now they're all approaching 60, so they started them in the 43 riot. And it was probably an outgrowth from the old flyer. They used to have a car they'd send out to trouble with six cops that would just break everybody's head in sight, no matter if they're passers-by, or, you know, old ladies aren't there. And that they quieted things down that way. Well, those are different days. But then they had the commando. So, I said, oh, God. So we went to work on that. And then I said, where do we keep our weaponry? They said it's in the municipal garage. I said, I want to see it. So we went over. Now this is shotguns, this is anything you need for heavy. Well, not nearly enough, my God. Heavy clubs, if you hit anybody with one, you'd kill them. You gotta kill them if you hit them in the ankle. gas, tear gas. I looked at the dates and Christ, it was outdated. It wouldn't work. It'd blow up. But the whole God ammunition, oh God, we had ammunition. All in one room on the second floor of the garage with not even a padlock on it. The whole city of Detroit, in the garage at police headquarters, which, you know, anybody can go in, there is a window and a door going into a room, and there is more ammunition there with a glass window like this and a door you could kick open. And this was everything we had, except the weapons that the police were carrying. So, Jesus Christ, I mean, I stayed up all night getting that stuff fixed. We had alarms put in. We dispersed it, you know, spread it around, getting it all out of the one place. And then we had that alarms put on that would bring the cruisers and bring additional police in if anyone went through that door without the thing first being taken off, and it bricked up. They could have stood on Jefferson Avenue and thrown a grenade in there and ruined the whole city. Just, I mean, you'd have nothing to work with. And they had the wall bricked up at the garage, and they had the stuff dispersed, as well as getting the plan. And then we had every policeman within a year, no matter what precinct, had riot training. Every policeman in the department had some riot training. And we, of course, were working in the public, with the public, trying to make community relations. We were disciplining police. We stopped this business of the police beating people up because they're black. And I say we stopped it because we were firing policemen who did it. And that had a hell of an effect. And no, never was any of this done before. The commissioner, if he ever got an inquiry and had an investigation made, would never get the results, as near as I can tell, of the investigation. It would be short-staffed along the line and be just covered. So nothing was done. It was not uncommon if a person, particularly a black, walked in a police station to complain about a policeman, that he'd get the piss kicked out of him and get locked up. You know, this, I'm not exaggerating. This is the way the thing happened. Particularly, of course, I don't think that happened much in the country club precinct, the 12th in Palmer Woods, where, but particularly the poor and those without clout or friends. I'm talking too much, Ed. You probably got prep.
No, I'm just delighted right now.
Oh, you probably had questions right
now.
But we did stop that. We did listen to complaints. So much needed to be get done that I couldn't do because I listened to people. I mean, they'd have a delegation. They want to see me, I'd see them. And if it was a problem, we'd work it out. And then, of course, there were so many militant groups then. Where are they today? I haven't the least idea. We ought to find out because it's significant. But Jesus Christ, a guy like Wadsworth was then NAACP secretary. And he was a son of a bitch because he'd say one thing to me and go right out in the hall and tell the reporters the opposite. We had police in our, we had a community relations thing, which I thought was the last place I'd have to look. They were the one because of Edwards. I believe that George was, well, I found out, finally found out, that the blacks, it was mixed, black and white, racially mixed, and I found out that the blacks weren't talking to the whites and vice versa, and they hated each other. And that they were after revolt. Also, the confidential records were disappearing from there and the turning up in the hands of black militants. And I would get a report, and this has happened, here are the facts. Somebody out there in a group would get a report, I don't know from the same guy or not, would be just the opposite to mine. And it took us a little time to figure out what was happening because they must have thought I was a goddamn liar, whoever, you know, sat in that chair. And you had these young groups, well, all ages. Hell, everybody was militant. The Cotillion Club, the social elite of the black community, which is, you know, they have a ball and they have debutantes and they do little scholarship things. And by God, if they didn't get a militant committee going of police community relations and each group. Look, one of the troubles is I had a hard time convincing those I didn't know that we weren't adversaries in this goddamn thing. Look, we got a problem. I recognize it. You recognize it. Let's see if we can't find a way that'll work out because they think all you got to do is snap your fingers, you know, and say, don't do that anymore with your thousands of people who are tradition bound, and you can stop it that way. It's a son of a bitch to stop. These guys are hard to handle. I can screw you in any way. So you gotta, and you gotta back them if you possibly can, or you've got no morale or no police department, and get them to do the thing right and satisfy the other people. You just can't call somebody in and say, look, tomorrow we're all going to tip our hats every time we pass a black person. It doesn't work out that way. They had issued an order that after I left, they had their names sewn on their shirts. They just now got an arbitration in the thing, so they're just now doing it. That's 3 years almost from the time the order went out. and you're dealing with a lot of very biased people. But, and a lot of good ones.
Ray, was CCR of any help to you in the summer of 67 in terms of intelligence about what was happening on the streets?
Frankly, no. I think I knew, I think I would get more information on my own telephone. And I'd say the police weren't too good either. No. I knew, I was very, I ought to mention this, I was very suspicious. One thing bothered me a lot in 67. Well, of course, we had the blue flu, you know, which could have been avoided, but wasn't. And that was a bastard thing to go through. And then we, because the city just wouldn't recognize the fact that the police department now was a union, the legislature had given them the right to collective bargaining. What the hell? That's unionism, except that they didn't have the right to strike. So they, very easy to get around that by being sick. But we had a hell of a time getting any, working out any intelligence from the black community. They were, you know, so resentful of the police. We couldn't, yeah, couldn't break in. And I used everything I knew to do. I had, fortunately, friends, both legitimate and criminal. But the thing that bothered me was this, that the really, the most, for want of a better term, radical or militant, groups or individuals hadn't been in to see me that summer. Now, I was so goddamn busy with the, you know, the flu and everything else, as you are over there, that I sent word and I made inquiries. Why hadn't anybody been in? Ask them to come in. Some, or if there's some reason they don't want to come in anymore, I'll go meet them. You know, under the Belle Isle Bridge at midnight if they want to talk. I think that many of them reached the point that there's no use talking anymore. Let's burn this son of a bitch down. Maybe that'll get their attention. I think now. But there wasn't a hell of a lot more I could do about that. Well, you couldn't change a thing any faster than we were because, oh, Jesus Christ. We did things in that police department that were just unheard of. I mean, taking people to the trial board for mistreating a citizen. Not only that, but firing him even, or suspending him 6 months or 10 months, and transfers all over the place, which makes it rough because a transfer can, that kind of transfer, can make their... can reduce their, what's it called, their points that they get for good, for being a good policeman. They go to another precinct and they drop about 10 right off the bat because they're new there. It's a bad theory. I don't think it should work that way, but it does. They then all that's added up when it's time for them to be promoted. And if they have been transferred a lot, they get harder time being promoted.
Ray, can I interject a question before I forget it? You mentioned how the civic leaders, the black leaders, had failed in Detroit just as they'd failed in every other city. Is that
the day of the riot?
Yeah, on the day of the riot. Yeah. Is that because the proletariat that was doing the riot, they had lost confidence in their leaders, or the leaders were out of touch with the proletariat, or what?
I'm sure both. I'm sure that. The rioters on 12th Street, the morning that these people went out to talk to them, looked at them as Uncle Tom, as captors of the whites. And I will generalize, at least in theory, that this is why they're not, it's the tough militant who can persuade them to take tough action, and not the preachers.
Wasn't it also true, Ray, that the black establishment leaders were not identifying the rioters as their people? They were saying, these are criminals, it's not a racial question. And they were the ones who were demanding harsh action.
You mean on that morning?
Yes.
Yeah, that's true, except that like the day before that, if one of those awful criminals, or say three of them, had jumped a policeman and two other policemen came to his aid and the three criminals, well, all these wonderful high echelon people would be in with fire in their eyes protesting brutality. Now, how the hell do they know it's brutality? Could I tell? There's a fight. How do you know how many punches to throw? I went by the rule that once a guy isn't fighting anymore, you stop fighting too, because anything in addition to that, you're in trouble. And this was maybe not a fair way, but it was the most, it was the fairest whack. But you see, there are some bad things happened during the riot, and naturally on both sides, but there were some bad excesses on the part of some police. Everybody's got a breaking point, and these guys can be walking down the street, mind their own business, and blow up a copper. They don't resign from the human race when they join the police department. And it's a lousy job, and considering their background and their training, they can blow up too. Others do it, where the police aren't supposed to. They're not allowed to, but it's understandable that sometimes they do. And those emotional, spur-of-the-moment things I can look at with a lot more understanding and tolerance and a plan. You know, we'll make this son of a bitch tell us he did it if it takes us 3 days.
Ray, coming back to the question of black revolutionaries, were there movements and whereabouts under surveillance before the riot?
We had, let me get my timetable. We had some under surveillance, but it was a tough damn surveillance to maintain because we had practically no black officers. We didn't know the black officers we had well enough to know if we could trust them. This was the awful part about this and all other police departments. You say, gee, here's a guy, here's a hell of a good policeman, but can I give him a thing like this to do? One. Or if I give it to him, if you know his background and know that he's good and will stand up, the whole black community knows he's a cop. As far as getting, I managed to get some informants. I got some fairly good information, but you don't know how far you can trust them because they haven't proved themselves. See, it was a new experience, completely far away from police work. Nobody ever thought this was possible. I mean, going back years. It was an inferior race, and you know, they were kicked around, they weren't allowed in the police department, they were given the worst jobs, they weren't promoted. There was terrible discrimination, even in getting in the police department. I like to think we overcame a lot of it, but this was a terrible thing for the people of Detroit. Because we didn't have the intelligence we should have. And not only didn't we have it, we had a hell of a hard time finding out who to send to get it or where to go to get it.
What I have in mind, Ray, is this, that to the extent that you did have some intelligence, is it possible, based on the movements and actions of the militants that you were aware of, that you can absolutely reject the conspiracy theory? In other words, on the basis of your intelligence, can you say that they were as surprised by the operation?
This was spontaneous, I'm convinced. I am convinced that this was not a conspiracy, that this was a spontaneous situation You see, the very fact that one of the cops had stopped the car out on a hunch, the raid wasn't planned, and the whole thing hinged on that raid. Plus, a lot of other things I've learned, but I think the militants immediately got together once it had started. I think the telephones, the stores of guns, and were not enormous and built up later. The Molotov cocktails were brought out. I think that an organization, not organization, is hardly. Marty, would you open? She's got her hands full. Thanks. Thanks, Frank. Yeah. I think that, you know, groups would immediately, after it started, by immediately, 2 hours, 3 hours, when the word got around. You see, it didn't go on the radio. It was held back. They knew it. They censored themselves to keep people away. We didn't ask them to. We had asked them previously, suggested to them, probably be a better way, that when we had racial trouble, it would be of great help to the city if they'd hold up, if they could, putting it on the air, because once it got on the air, it attracted crowds and it hampered the efforts of the police and the others to work to smooth it over. This didn't get on the air until, I don't know the time, but it was several hours after it had been going. And we had another one. There are 33,000 people at a doubleheader ball game. The Tigers were playing the Yankees. All right, what do? You tell them, don't go on 12th Street. You know, you panic them, and they're the riot. Who didn't know about the riot? Just come. A lot of people didn't. And do you tell them, don't go on, go by way of Grosse Pointe? Because by the time they were going to get out of the ball game, we still had it pretty well confined to 12th, with the exception of one big fire on Linwood. And just a little looting there. But I decided to tell them that there's a little trouble. Nothing to worry about, but to go home by other streets, and I think 12th.
Was that announced at the ballpark?
Yeah, Joe Gentile put on the speaker. That's a problem. What are you going to do? You got 33 dimensions. They might blow up on you, too. But, and then, of course, the National Guard. No, we'd worked very closely with the National Guard. Jesus, land galore. But they were up at Grayling.
Hello.
Summer camp.
No, I know.
And
yeah, I tell you what, I'll call you back because
I was kind of reluctant. I don't know.
Of course.
And believe me, I've searched my mind about this, whether I should have just insisted to Jerry that he get the National Guard in here sooner. They couldn't have been here much sooner anyway. But, see, I worked with the National Guard in so many stories, and I knew what they are. I knew it would be slaughter if they came in. And it was. That I was trying to think, Jesus, can't we, you know, can a miracle happen, and can't we, get to handle this thing ourselves?
When was that decision made, to call the Guard? You had the state police in first, is that correct?
Yeah.
And that wasn't sufficient.
Oh, they have, no. It was in the morning, but it was late in the morning that we we knew that we had to have him.
When did you notify and involve the mayor in all the decisions?
I called him before 7 o'clock and got him up that morning. He was... he came down. But we're criticized for not getting the guardian sooner. If we had asked for them sooner than we did, we couldn't have gotten them in Detroit. Because they were out in the field and they were spread around grailing. And we couldn't have gotten them back much sooner than we did. And then, a bad thing, I know enough about these operations to know that you don't commit troops piecemeal. But the way they were coming in Detroit and the way the city was going, we had to commit them piecemeal. And naturally, they got chewed up. And this is what you do, but what we're doing is buying time. Now, this I can't verify, but I'm told by people in the police department who were there, I had to go to a meeting. I had to go out to 10th Precinct, see it, and also go to a meeting at the citizens in the police station. And the... as to what they could do and what they wanted to do. And we had two kinds of citizens, pro-police and anti-police. We were already being called brutal. And this was early afternoon. We were already being called brutal and we were already being told we weren't doing enough by this group and by, you know, citizens who were invited.
Do you care to name names?
Well, I don't remember. There were business people around the neighborhood. They were neighborhood
people. Oh, I thought you were referring to the black leaders.
No. No, at this meeting, it was a large one. It took up the whole basement. That is the auditorium part of the basement of the Liberty precinct. And there were people, business people and residents of that area. I would generalize this way, that the older people wanted us to do more, and the younger ones were the were claiming that we were brutal. And it's very possible that there had been some acts of brutality. By that time, I doubt it. I doubt it, because...
Had the first fatality occurred as yet?
No. The first fatality was a woman riding in a car on Woodward Avenue. Around Claremont, she was hit by a stray bullet, and it was that night, Sunday night.
Ray, along those lines, maybe I'm jumping
now,
ahead.
I may be wrong on my night. I think it was Sunday. I have to verify.
I recall writing that in my notes when I was doing this.
That it was Sunday.
You know, the newspaper accounts look like every other person in the black community was a sniper. Yeah. How many snipers do you think there were, Ray?
10% of what we, what was the count? Whatever the count was, I'd say maybe 15% were actually snipers.
Of incidents reported?
Reported snipers. I'd say maybe, this has to be guesswork because there's no way to verify, except, you see, it's, you know, street fighting in a, where there are a lot of buildings is a very tough way to fight.
Yeah.
And you had, when the National Guard came in, there were a bunch of country kids scared to death in the city anyway. I don't mean that they lack personal courage, but they're in a strange environment, let's face it. Somebody take a shot, it'd be dark, and somebody, you know, curfew we got in. So, boom, you take a shot at some, Jesus, sniper, boom, boom, boom at the sniper. Sniper goes all around. Then everybody's a sniper. But there were two kinds of snipers. There were the casual sniper who would be in his apartment drinking whiskey and then get up and take his rifle and stand back from the window. This was bad. They weren't coming up to the window. You, at night even, you couldn't see a flash. It's new enough to stand back and go bang, 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 and then go back to his whiskey.
Aiming at anything in particular?
Well, it's preferably. But if he didn't have a target, he'd shoot anybody. And then there was a real smarty, and this was the dedicated guy who would pick a spot and take a shot, preferably at a cop or something that was going to do some damage, and then go like a bastard, disappear in the dark and without, and because they were, you couldn't calm down these, either the police, a lot of the police, or the National Guard. It was awful hard to get them calm. They'd concentrate their fire on the place where he was. Now, by this time, he's over in someplace else taking another shot. You don't have to have many smart people like that to do damage, and there is that kind of sniper.
Right. Hubert Black's book suggests that there was some organized sniping, coordinated sniping, at police stations around the city. He logs it by time to suggest that it was coordinated.
It could have been, yeah. You see, yeah. When the whole goddamn town's going that way, there could be so many coincidences that they don't, that the timing and all don't necessarily indicate to me that it's organized. But there is firing at some police stations. However, I think even that was exaggerated. I think, maybe I shouldn't say. But one lieutenant was calling from under his desk saying he was under fire. We sent everything out there and couldn't find a goddamn indication that the station had been under fire at all. I don't think it was. However, I wasn't there, I can't say he's wrong. But he was down on the floor under his desk calling headquarters, and we were able to get an awful lot of stuff. He told us the direction it was coming from, so we could go in the back and everything. Couldn't find it. Maybe it had gone. But we didn't find the bullet marks either.
So the time logs that Locke cites are merely reports, not necessarily verified.
That's it. The reports. And the radios were going so fast. There was never a second between. You know, they were just piled up. And you couldn't verify very much.
Could you verify, Ray, any of those reported instances of firing on fire companies?
Yes. I don't remember about the firing, but the rock throwing and the bottle throwing.
Uh-huh.
Fire departments, the first one, I think it was Sunday afternoon, pulled right out of a fire in 12th Street. We couldn't, by that time, give them protection. And basically couldn't protect ourselves. And I've got a theory, too, that the fireman who was shot through the head, and it's only a theory, was shot accidentally I don't like to say it. I think National Guard, but I can't.
Yeah.
You know, it's a theory.
Yeah, sure.
We couldn't get the damn bullet, so you couldn't mash it up with anything. When it was a through and through, and the bullet just disappeared.
Ray, how much manpower was diverted to the protection of public utilities?
Well, we.
Excuse me just a second.
All right. Yeah.
Let's get back to that morning. Do you want to shut it off? When the superintendent called me at 5 o'clock that Sunday morning, and I told him not to take them and the police off the east side.
Yeah.
I was afraid, as I say, that this could be a diversion, that the main thrust might be on the east side. And on the east side, we have the waterworks, we have the Edison plants, we have the Belle Isle, the radio, east side radio, Belle Isle. Police radio, that is. We had, you know, Chrysler, Park Davis with all its narcotics, and a lot of men, plus half the population in Detroit. So I couldn't see Leaving.
No.
You're not leaving now. I was afraid of that. Oh, all right.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you, sir?
Good. I didn't see him come up there. So, you know, I was kind of worried about that. Now, we were had to be very haphazard about that, like leave a man or keep it under. He asked me how to get about the security. But then we got our emergency, we got citizens who we knew to fill in until the National Guard came. When the National Guard came, they took over.
There is something called the police reserve.
Which we built up. It's a police emergency reserve. It's a thing I was always opposed to because you can you get the screwballs. You know, you make them on there. He's an unpaid policeman in crisis after me, shooting people and everything else. However, we put through a program and got, I had over 1,000 people that you could depend on. So if anything like that happened, and they were trained to them, and they would go, and their job was to guard the utility. So we wouldn't be without water, and we had that pretty well down. But I don't know whether they still have it. But the trouble wasn't keeping them interested. There wasn't enough for them to do. But they were substantial people. We checked them out. We got all kinds of applications. People that we just couldn't take a chance on. And, yeah, it's... Oh.
Mary, I'm going to excuse myself in about 10 minutes because I... 5 minutes, because I want to... No, I don't want to over-retire you.
Oh,
you
know?
I set a time limit of 2 hours. For, you know, I could listen to you talk all night.
Oh.
But
no, it's... all right, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. Ray, you were out on the streets the night before the riot.
Yeah, I'm in to point to be on the streets a great deal at night. And the night before, my wife Mary and I had driven out to see a friend of mine who had been held up on the northwest section. I wanted to see if he was hurt and recovering all right. And we then drove through the 10th precinct, and I mean really, it's a big precinct, but we covered an awful lot of it that night, just to get the feeling of the streets. No particular reason, I did this frequently. It was a hot night, the streets were crowded, the homes were hot, but the people all seemed, there didn't seem to be any hostility. In particular, they seemed normal, friendly, there were no indication. It was a low crime night, too, in the whole city. For the 24 hours prior to the riot, there were only about 4 holdups, and as opposed to roughly 18 a night now, 18 or 20. There are no indication, of course, and I still think that it was just a combination of circumstances, with people on the streets who were very bitter people and who wanted to get something started and who did manage that night to do it. I think that despite all the Mayor of Detroit, Jerry Cavanaugh, had done, and the police had done, and many agencies of the city under the mayor had done to improve, and of course many, many black citizens had done to improve race relations and correct so many evils, that if it hadn't been that night, we'd have had a riot. Every city did. Large and practically every city, large and small, but all the large ones. And I think we'd have had it. And this just happened to be the occasion. But there is, as I say, very little crime, no no racial incidents reported that night. I got the call. I started chatting from the superintendent of police about 5 o'clock Sunday morning. He said, "I think we've got trouble at Claremont and 12th." And he told me about the raid and said that they were fighting and he was getting people out, police out, and we were already calling them back, the ones we could reach. But unfortunately, it was beautiful weather. Many of them left for a day at the lake with their families. And those who had 2 days off had already gone. Pardon me. But it was hard for me to get out of my home. I got best when my phone kept ringing. My administrative assistant, Hubert Locke, called, and the owner, the editor of the Detroit Chronicle, which is a black-oriented newspaper in Detroit, a weekly call. He wanted to get more men right out there and get rough and stop it, and the paper had the headline the following week saying it could have been stopped. He thought we should use more force. Ironically, his paper was constantly accusing the police of using too much force in prior and subsequent occasions. However, he said many people call, and it's hard to get out. I went out, and the first person I saw on the way to my car was Judge Wade McCree, a neighbor who was black, and I told him, it was still very early, I told him, he was delivering his little boy's paper route because his son was sick. I told him about it, so he was the first citizen outside of that neighborhood to know. But I told him at that time that it looked, from all reports, it was serious and we were in for it. And I said to my wife before I left, "Look, I'm afraid this is going to last a long time. Why don't you just go over to the cottage? We have a cottage in Lake Erie in Canada." And not because I thought there was any danger to her. I knew there wasn't. But I knew that I wouldn't be home for more than a change of clothes and shower, maybe. So she said something that I hadn't thought of, and she was right. She said, "If I leave here, all of Lafayette Park will leave too." And it was true because there are many, many inquiries as to where she was from residents of the area who were naturally being right downtown. And a lot of violence occurring just outside on the periphery of the park as to whether she had left or whether she was there. And I think it was reassuring to people to know that she stayed there. But I hadn't thought of that effect she did.
Ray, one of the events of the summer before the riot, the summer of 67 preceding the riot, mm-hmm. was the shooting of a black husband at Rouge Park.
Yeah.
Do you give that much weight as a contributing factor?
No. No, I don't. It was a horrible thing. I really don't. Because while there is a great deal of resentment over it among black people, and rightly so, it was a brutal murder. The police did work on it, worked on it hard, and did arrest and prosecute successfully the person who committed who murdered this black man in front of his wife, incidentally, for no reason. There was no fight, he just killed him. But there was some dissatisfaction. Of course, the case at that time, by the time of the riot, wasn't really final. There was resentment later that because others in that crowd were not prosecuted. But the prosecutor and the police felt that they had a case against one man of the four or five who were in this crowd, and one man only, and they couldn't connect the others up with a criminal act, and it would weaken their case against the man who committed the murder, and that was their thinking, and that's why they prosecuted one, and they did, successfully. No, I don't think it did. And during the riot, we didn't have any of the usual, of the often accusations of police brutality, and there wasn't anything that seemed to be voiced against the police during the riot. And it wasn't, of course, a race riot in the sense that one race, well, in 43, when in Detroit, when the blacks and the whites were fighting. This was a revolution, a riot by black people over, I think, the system.
You reject as cosmetic the claim made at the time that it was a truly integrated riot.
Well, I do. We arrested a few people, just a handful of white people for participating in the looting. There weren't many observed. You see, the looting and the burning were in black neighborhoods, and white people just didn't go in there and participate. Maybe they're afraid to. I don't know why they didn't, but they didn't. And while some whites got involved on the lawless side, there were very few. I could hardly say it was integrated unless, let's call it a tokenism.
And in the working class but integrated neighborhoods like Del Rey, there really wasn't any trouble.
And there wasn't anything down there at all. I saw black. You mean in the black part of Del Rey?
Well, it's kind of mixed.
Yeah, it is mixed. But there was no trouble down there at all. Those are people who own their own homes, too. But you see, I think that there's a large criminal element involved in it. There's no question about that. And a large militant element involved in it. But there's a large number of decent, law-abiding black people who had never been involved in criminal acts before. Certainly, as far as the police knew, because they had no records, and they had jobs and owned their homes, and had no trouble. They got caught up in this awful hysteria.
Do you go along with the thought that the composition of the 12th Street neighborhood was rootless? That there were a lot of people who had just moved in and who really were not raised in that community.
Oh yes, oh yes. That area is pretty transient. That is a lot of in the apartments. On the street, there are a lot of transients, people who don't stay long. That, of course, is true of the city to such a greater extent than it used to be. And people who advocate the beat patrolman being out there say, well, he knows everybody in the neighborhood. Not anymore, he wouldn't. If we could have beat patrolman, fine. But they're in cars because they can do so much, cover so much more territory. And knowing the people is different because there's so much mobility in really in all parts of the city. But no, the people in the 12th Street area on that day did not have their roots there at all. It was predominantly white until after the World War II, until after World War II. So the roots were not very, very deep. But many people who, for the first time in their lives, by people, are buying their homes, can't afford, can buy their homes, were doing it and are doing it in that area and took great pride in it. And they had lovely single and duplexes on the streets feeding into 12 and surrounding the area where the rioting was the worst. However, I've been concentrating on 12th. We'll have to take the other parts of the city too, where the rioting was bad. Because while it started on 12th, and while the worst damage was concentrated there, it was very, it spread, and it was very serious in other all black neighborhoods in the city. And of course, a lot of the wreckage is still there.